everybody, welcome to episode 27 of Literary Disco, the flimsy little plastic miracles episode. We will begin today with a bookshelf roulette in which Todd, Julia, and I are forced to take a book at random down from our shelves and defend our ownership of it. And then we will dive headfirst into the incredibly honest world of Ron Curry Jr.'s new novel, Flimsy Little Plastic Miracles. I am actor and filmmaker Ryder Strong. Joining me are essayist and radio personality Julia Pistel and novelist and critic Todd Goldberg. Welcome, guys.
Word Hello. To your mother.
Just seconds ago on this lovely Sunday morning, we got numbers from you guys for our favorite game, Bookshelf Roulette. So the first thing we asked for is a number between 1 and 4, and I just want to tell you guys that the first person who answered, someone named Janair.
Hi, Janair. Thanks for answering. Janair.
No, you're not going to thank her because she said pie, so I don't really know how to deal with that.
That's 3.14. Look, sarcasm isn't appreciated when we're trying to get a show done, Janair.
Yeah, exactly. So I asked for an integer this time, and Kai02121 gave us 3.
Oh,
so
thanks,
we're
going
to start in the third corner of our bookshelves. Then, thanks to Brock Kreutzfeldt, it's quite a name.
Third corner is the bottom left.
No, bottom right.
Bottom right.
Bottom right.
And then
we're
going to go 5 shelves up and then 15 books over. Okay?
3, 5, 15. All right, I'll be right back.
3, 5, 15. Okay, guys, what do we got?
We spun the wheel of roulette. I landed on a Charles Bukowski book called Betting on the Muse, which is a collection of poems and stories that I have not read. And I probably owned this since it was published in 1997, because that was the last time I cared about Bukowski when I was 17 years old.
The time he should have the least amount of influence on you, by the way.
Because I clearly went through a phase when I was 15 to 17 where I bought all the poems and I read them and thought, you know, especially living in Los Angeles, there's like this romantic quality to like this old drunk writer who just gets up every day and drinks his beer and writes and then has sex with women all night. Actually, it goes well with Ron Curry's book, which we're going to talk
about.
Yes,
it does.
Yes, it really does.
The Bukowski model of like masculinity and writerliness and alcoholism. It was, you know, it's really attractive to you when you're a teenage boy living in Los Angeles, I guess. But now I just can't stand him, and I don't know, it has nothing to do with his actual writing, because I can't really talk about his writing, because I haven't read it since then. But as a pop figure, it sort of goes back to, I remember that one episode we talked about Edgar Allan Poe's popular, you know, and I feel like Bukowski is a figure like that. He's a very popular literary identity, in the same way that, you know, a lot of the classic great drunks are. Well, what's his name?
Many of the great drunks.
Arthur from Arthur.
No. I'm talking about writers. Hunter S. Thompson, right? Like, we all, like, you know, there's so many people that just worship at the altar of Hunter S. Thompson, and they may have not even read any of his books. They just love this image and this idea of this guy. And I feel like Bukowski's the same way. It's like, how many people really are in love with Bukowski's poetry? How many people love Bukowski's stories? I don't know. I mean, I kind of have a tendency to roll my eyes when people talk about Bukowski, because I feel like they're not often talking about the literature itself. They're talking about this identity, this larger-than-life quality of Bukowski. But people say the same thing about Kerouac, and I'm a big defender of Kerouac, as I obviously have defended him on the show before. But I understand why people feel that way about Kerouac, but I actually believe the text itself is really good. I don't feel that way about Bukowski, but I also haven't revisited it. So, I don't know.
I haven't read him in years either, but I saw Barfly not too long ago in the middle of the night on cable. And when the first time I saw the movie Barfly, I thought, oh, man, that's the life of the writer. And then I saw the movie again recently, and I was like, number one, it's a horrible movie.
Really?
Number two, Mickey Rourke is a horrible actor, at least in that film. And number three, you know, it's like torture porn, watching a guy fall apart. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, I went through a very brief phase of Bukowski too when I was in college. But I've never necessarily been attracted to the self-abuse angle of being a writer, perhaps because I just do it in my head, so therefore I don't need to have it with the alcohol. But, you know, I think his vision of sort of a gritty L.A. and of the his depiction of life here, I think holds up still. I don't know necessarily if I'd want to read his books or poetry again, but what I recall about them is thinking that he had captured that sort of underside of LA in a right. pretty good fashion.
I mean, I've only read basically his like little essays or, you know, things that he wrote when he was older, and I liked them, but I was never in a position to, like, I was too old when I read them and too not like a young masculine man wanting to be a writer. Like, I was never going to have the experience of like, this is who I want to be, you know yeah. what I mean? And that's where it really gets into a danger zone. Well, not danger, but like, it's completely true what you're saying, writers. Like, there's, if you can not read those people when you're impressionable, I feel like you get a much clearer view of them
right.
later.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I feel lucky in that I didn't read him when I was 18 or 19 / a man.
Did you guys ever read a book called Ask the Dust by John Fonte?
Yes.
No.
Yes. It's a wonderful book.
That's, if people, I wanted to bring him up because wonderful if people book. Like Bukowski, like any of our listeners, I would highly recommend the reading Ask the Dust by John Fonte. He's somebody, when I moved into my first apartment at 16 in downtown Los Angeles, and I probably was reading Bukowski at that time, somebody recommended, oh, downtown Los Angeles, you need to read this John Fonte book because it's all about living in downtown Los Angeles in the 1920s or 30s. Mm-hmm. And I bought the John Fonte book, and the introduction was written by Bukowski because Bukowski was obsessed with John Fonte. He was sort of the first alcoholic writer struggling in Los Angeles.
The first two got published.
In LA.
So, but he was the first famous one, yeah. So Bukowski really looked up to him, and I love this book. I actually reread it not that long ago, and it does hold up. That's a great work of literature. The movie was horrible.
The movie's dreadful.
Yeah, there was a movie made not that long ago, like 5 years ago, with Colin Farrell. What's his name? Colin Farrell? Yeah, horrible movie, but a great book and quick read, and sort of for me what I wish Bukowski was had more of, which is a complete story with a beginning, middle, and end, an actual novel. Did Bukowski even write novels, or was it all short stories?
I think they're all short stories.
Yeah,
I think. Well, and you know, I think also Fonte was just a better writer.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's just what it is, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think you know, Ask the Dusk is continually brought up as, you know, is this the quintessential LA novel? And usually about this time every year when the LA Times Festival of Books comes along, which for listeners in Southern California is April 20th and 21st at the campus of USC. And I think it's hard to pinpoint what makes LA a great place to write books about. And I wrote a piece about this last year at this time in the LA Times about, you know, what makes LA literature. And I think the thing that always has fascinated me and what makes Fonte and to some lesser extent in my mind Bukowski interesting is that they don't ever try to find the center. They just sort of write where they are. And I think the challenge of writing LA fiction is people are always trying to define what this strange, diffuse place is when you just can only describe where you are, you know, at any given time.
Okay. I'll go next since we're talking about place, because what I landed on, this is hilarious, is my Lonely Planet Guide to China.
China!
But, so I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but you guys know this. I lived in China for a year, and the Lonely Planet Guide to all of China is quite large. It is
turns out it's a pretty big country.
It's 980 pages. And, every time I move, I'm like, why do I have this? It's so out of date. You know, it was 2005 that I was there. But I cannot let this book go because I was in China for so long and I traveled all around the country. I went everywhere. That I carried this fucking like 3-pound book with me the entire time. And it feels like a part of me now to a degree that I cannot separate myself from this book. Like, it would be very hard to actually get rid of it. And, like, I, you know, there's all this writing in it, just like Todd's. Like, I just found, there's pages falling out, the whole thing. But I just found, like, all these post-it notes with Chinese writing from my students on it. Like, okay, I can't read this at all. But I'm very attached. And let's see if there's anything good in here. Yeah, like, hostels that don't exist, maps that are wrong now. But I just...
Democracy.
No, that's not in here.
Oh, sorry.
But I mean, it's I don't know. What do you guys think? Do you throw out old travel books and travel guides?
No.
I've had a couple purging sessions, but I still keep a lot of them. Yeah.
I think we have all of our old fold-out maps of crazy cities we've gone to. But you know what I just heard? That Frommer's, which was bought by Google, is no longer going to put out a print version of their guides.
Oh. Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. Just carry a smartphone wherever you go.
Right.
And pretty much find what you need. Which.
But
is...
man, when I was going to go places, I know it's a different time now, obviously, but I would take that travel guide and, you know, weeks before we go somewhere, I would be reading and bookmarking and sitting in the bathroom. I was sitting in the bathroom, reading it and underlining and putting toilet paper into little places in the book where I was interested.
Yeah.
And it's just, that was like it became, like Julia's saying, it became like your thing. If you didn't have your guide, you were going to end up in child slavery or something.
And for me, and I mean, like, I always wanted to go off the book and stuff, you know, because I was that kind of traveler. I am that kind of traveler. But also, for me, it was like the maps. You know, it was, okay, I'm going to learn this map. I'm going to figure out this map. I mean, I can't even tell you how many times I've said to Greg, like, hey, give me the map. I want to look at the map. You know, like, where are we? Let me look at myself in this space, you know. And that's all, it's all changing so much. I mean, this is a total Luddite conversation that it's just going to be very outdated. Like, we went to Greece a couple of years ago, and I did exactly what you're saying, Todd. I did it again, but more for like, no, I'm still doing this than the actual need to do it.
Practicality, yeah.
Yeah.
Which leads me to my pick, which is a book called, which actually it's oddly relevant for our discussion today about Ron Curry's book. It is a book called Crust, by Lawrence Schoenberg, and it's a book I reviewed several years ago somewhere, I think the LA Times maybe, and it is about a famous author named Lawrence Schoenberg who finds incredible, earth-shattering enlightenment while picking his nose. And he brings forth an entire religion and philosophy about picking your nose called nasalism. And the book is a faux memoir, and it's also a really big satire.
Sounds incredibly bizarre, but
it's
cool.
An incredibly bizarre book. For instance, this is just on page 15. It's thoroughly noted and whatnot, like a
footnotes critical.
It's footnotes everywhere. So, for instance, it says here. I'd published 24 books, 12 fiction, 10 nonfiction, and 2 essay collections. And there's a little star, and it says, 2 National Book Awards, a Lannan Lifetime Achievement Award, a Pulitzer Prize, membership in the American Academy of Arts. And then he goes down and says, the last 7 books I'd written, including The Complete Book of AIDS, The Complete Book of 9/11, and The Complete Book of Terrorism, had brought me attention and honor that dwarfed what I'd known before. The Complete, says they're known, owed no small debt, blah, 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 blah. And so it's also a book about the conglomeration of different corporations. So as I recall, like Microsoft and Fox News become one and all sorts of different things. And so it's a bizarre, strange, very funny novel. And I had never heard of Lawrence Schoenberg before. And he had apparently written a book called Brain Surgeon, An Intimate View of His World, and Memories of Amnesia.
That's a good title.
It's a fascinating book, yeah.
Did you give it a positive review?
I did. And this was in 2008, it looks like. But it's a bizarre little book, and it's one of those metafiction books, not unlike Ron Curry's, where the author... is in the book, except that Lawrence Schoenberg has a different name in this. He goes by Walter Linchak in the book. But it's a really weird, unusual book. But what I wanted to talk about is $2 Radio. This was, I think, one of their first books. And $2 Radio has gone on to publish a lot of really great, interesting writers, most notably Joshua Moore, whose book Damascus was out last year, is a fantastic, fantastic book. And they're a great little small press out of, I want to say, Ohio, if I remember correctly, and they just publish whatever they want to publish, a couple books a year, and they don't really care too much if it's commercial or not. They figure that the books are going to find their own audience, and they have really found their own audience to get reviewed in all the right places, and they find interesting, compelling new voices. And Crust was my my first entrance into it. And as a person who really likes to pick their nose, also, I, you know, I have great hope that one day I'll reach that level of
enlightenment
as well. Yeah, and the cover is great. The cover is vaguely he refers to boogers as crusts. And the cover is the cover of Crust is Crust in the Google letters, basically, the Google colors. It's a very strange book.
That sounds
very
really weird.
Book. It is weird, but I recommend it highly. I should probably look at the review and said what I said about it, but I remember saying that I liked it.
Okay.
So there you go, Crust by Lauren Shanberg.
Bukowski, China, and boogers. That's your
that
roulette
leads us
today.
Perfectly.
It really does. It kind of does.
I don't know about China, but
no, it
but
does. There's a huge travel element in
yes,
Von Curry's
there
book.
Is a travel element with that stays off book. It should be noted. He just goes.
Dun dun dun.
Stick around, and when we return, we will discuss Ron Curry Jr.'s flimsy little plastic.
Welcome back, everybody. We are here today to talk to you first and foremost about your prostate. We'll get to that in the second hour. Before that, we're going to talk about a fantastic new book by Ron Curry called Flimsy Little Plastic Miracles. And I should note my bias here, which is that I'm a huge Ron Curry Jr. fan. Huge. Massive. He might be... Well, let me put it this way. After my father died, Ron took over that role of being my dad. No,
have
that's
you ever
not true.
Met him in person?
I've never met him in person. So here's the story. I read his first book, God is Dead, and reviewed it for the LA Times. We talked about this not too long ago on an episode, but most of what I talked about got cut, actually. How dare you? So I reviewed his book, God is Dead, for the LA Times. This was a long time ago. This was like 6 or 7 years ago. And I loved it, and so I think he reached out to me, or I reached out to him after I reviewed it, and we just became friends. But I've never met him in real life. I've only talked to him on the internet machine. But I like the guy, and I read his second book, Everything Matters, which is absolutely remarkable. It's about a little kid who knows when the world is going to end.
Ooh, that sounds really good.
It is really good. And so I know him in the way that a lot of writers know one another, which is that we know them... We know each other's font faces, but have never met in real life. When I read this book, I read it right after it came out, and I reread it before our show, and it just came out 2 months ago or so. I immediately contacted Ron in the middle of the night and said, "You're a fucking genius, and I hate you," because that's how people talk to each other when they know each other only through the Facebook machine. So I didn't get a chance to review it in a normal place because I felt like I was too friendly with him that I couldn't review it in print. But here... We have no biases. This is our show. We can log roll the people all we want to. Fortunately, I really like the book, so it doesn't make it difficult to talk about it with my great praise. And the plot is actually pretty simple. A novelist named Ron Curry Jr.
This is going to be hard to talk about because there's so many... The sort of doublings of reality and not reality that I was confused by it.
It is a little confusing. So a novelist named Ron Curry Jr. writes, this is his memoir, Flimsy Little Plastic Things, and it details his life in a Caribbean island as he pines for a woman he can't have, his descent into madness, and the death that he fakes.
That's giving a lot away. Should we...
It's in the front flap, which made me mad. That made me mad.
Because I didn't know it was coming at all, because I never read the front flap or the back of any book.
Yeah, never read the front flap, anyone, ever.
Ever. Okay, so we're not giving it away. He fakes his own death.
He fakes his own death and
becomes a really famous writer.
After his death, yes.
After his death. And so this is his memoir in quotes, of that transition and that period. It's a very... I don't know. I love this book, and I know you did too, Todd. But Julia, you have different feelings.
I did not like this book very much, everyone. But I want to hear why you guys loved it. Because my problem was, I mean, I think our listeners probably know at this point that I like go into every read ever being like, I will love this. So, but Okay, so as a nonfiction writer, I feel like I've spent so much time in the, like, what's true, what isn't true conversation that, yeah, okay, so I'll just lay out my, like, my main thing that got me to, I couldn't get past this. There's the so much of it, and it's right at the beginning, is about, like, this could be true, it could not be true, you know, and that's fine, and I like those kind of confusions, but at this point, nothing had occurred. There was no what to be true or not true. So it was
That's true. That's a very good point, because it's a weird book structurally. Let's talk about how it's structured.
Yeah. Well, but first, let's just read this opening little paragraph. This comes after a very long epigraph that is not an epigraph. He says, the writer, the author, the narrator, says, it's important that you understand from the very outset here that everything I'm about to tell you is capital T true, or at least I will not deliberately engage in any lies of either substance or mission in talking with you here today. Which, for me as a reader, immediately says, everything not we're true. About to hear is a lie.
Yeah. So, yeah, so for me that's like, okay. Like, it immediately puts me on a, all right, I see what you're doing here. Now tell me something, you know, tell me something so that I can be curious about. This is it. I did not feel that this book gave me a chance to be curious about whether something was true or not true. It only told me that I would be grappling with those issues, which annoyed me. But I want to hear what you guys loved about this book.
Well, I'm going to tell you the first thing that I loved about this book, which is that he said something right at the beginning that really sort of shook me, which he said, and this is something, oddly enough, that Wendy and I had been talking about not too long ago, which is that all books, all fiction, all narrative is based on real events. He says in the book, oh, isn't it exciting when you see a movie and that thing flashes up that says based on a true story, based on real events? Doesn't that make you sit up and say, oh, I wonder about this? But that all fiction has to be based on real events because a real person has experienced events that would basically allow them to write that book. And for me, that was one of those, oh, shit, my mind is expanding moments. But it's not something that I haven't, I think, in some way intuited myself while reading it. And here is the thing that struck me most about this book and that its relationship to that line is that throughout the book, Ron writes about the death of the character Ron's father from cancer and the long process that is and what that's like. Reading it, I thought, holy shit, Ron's father must have died of cancer because his death is exactly how my mom died from cancer. Like the steps that you go through, the experiences that you have, the emotional, the physical, the tangible, all that stuff that he explains in those sections was so 99.9% the same as what it was like when my mother spent a decade dying of cancer. That I thought, oh, I need to contact him and see if this is true. And I thought, I am not going to contact him and see if this is true. Because, number one, it's not my business. And number two, if it's in here, maybe it's based on truth or maybe it's not. But he's experienced something that is emotionally as similar to what I experienced. And, you know, I can just share that through the book. And so, it's exactly what he says in the book, is that if you can feel something in some work of fiction, it's because you have felt that thing somewhere else. And I thought, oh, shit, he's doing that to me, that bastard. I hate him.
I think the cancer parts were by far the best part. But, I mean, this is just how I feel. It's like, I would rather read a book about cancer and feel emotionally moved by that, whether it is true or untrue. Like, I feel like I've had that conversation so many times that, like, I'm numb to it now, and all I want to do is be moved by a story. Like, the idea that every story is both true and not true simultaneously because of what you're saying, Todd, but also because of, like, our own perceptions and stuff. Like, that's something that I think most people do accept on a certain level. And I wanted to be moved not by whether or not something was true, but by the actual content of the story.
Well, oh, hold on. We have to ask the important question of Julia that we normally ask of Julia. Did you go on a Google Fest to find out all you could about Ron Curry Jr. after this?
I did not.
Oh, interesting.
She was not
inspired.
Didn't care. She didn't care. So, Julio, I think What you're saying is that you didn't like the essayistic qualities of this book, I think, right? Or the faux memoir aspect, the theorizing about what's true and what's not. You just wish that the story was more developed, or that the story expressed those by themselves without the sort of asides. Because the way the book is written is basically every page is its own chapter, and it's very direct address, right? Everything is Ron Curry Jr. talking to you as Ron Curry Jr. and saying things like, so here's this crazy thing that's happened. I'll tell you all about it. But before I tell you all about it, I got to... So it's all that sort of rambling, discursive style. And then there's three threads, really. There's the story of Emma, which is the love of his life that is, you know, sort of forcing him into the situation that he's in right now, where he's on an island drinking himself to death, essentially, while she goes...
With a co-ed, with a hot co-ed. Right.
Yes.
And then there's the thread of the father's cancer, which his father died a couple years before. Mm. But then there's this philosophical thread about singularity and the concept of computers becoming sentient beings, a la The Matrix or Terminator.
Google Glasses.
Right. So, but it's all sort of...
Glasses is the singularity. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Those Google Glasses, I was just reading about those, and I was like, you know what? That is the onset of the singularity. That's it.
All right. So, yeah, writer. Okay. So, I feel like... All right. It's true that I didn't like the demands on myself, whether like, ooh, I'm going to blow your mind right now. That's what I felt like the right up front, is this true or not true thing was. Right. But I do love, you know, I love David Foster Wallace. I love essays. I love like the thorniness when it is in service of a story or an idea that I am really, really engaged with. So I think part of my inability to connect with this book falls somewhat on, I mean, obviously it falls on me, but it falls on the idea that, like, I also, you know, the story of a man's obsessive, like, devotional love for one woman. It was such a male point of view book, and the women were so, like, exactly something I couldn't, you know, like, get in their heads, you know?
I know what you're talking
really
about.
It was really hard for me to...
Oh, I get it. I was rolling my eyes for the first 50 pages of this book in the exact same way. The note that I wrote was, this is the definition of a manic pixie dream girl. Do you guys know this phrase, manic pixie dream girl?
Okay. No, but so, I now have it tattooed on the small of my back.
Okay. You had never heard this, Todd?
No. Manic pixie. No.
Okay. So this is a phrase, man. I forget how it came, who invented it, but it's a phrase that critics have lobbed mostly against movies, right?
Zooey Deschanel.
And the idea is, Zooey Deschanel or basically any Cameron Crowe movie is built upon the premise of the manic pixie dream girl, which is
so
the idea that a writer or moody guy of some sort who's or Jerry Maguire, or an agent, whatever, some guy who's down and out in his luck, and he finds the manic pixie dream girl who's perfect in every way, and she is... all those things. She's sort of pixie in looks, but then she has this manic energy. She's so positive. She is artistic and inspirational, and drags him out of his doldrums and becomes a better person because of his love and obsessive love for this. So I thought that this book was it's basically a manic pixie dream girl, that he's obsessed with this girl, Emma, that he can never have, and she flits in and out of his life, and he wants her so bad. But then I started to feel like the book evolved and became self-aware that's what he was doing. And in a way, to me, this is a takedown of the manic pixie dream girl. And really, it came full circle for me in the character of Charlotte, who starts off as this undergrad that shows up and is sleeping with him while his heart is being broken by Emma, who he actually, you know, had a relationship with, and now she's gone. So he's on this island with this undergrad, Charlotte. And he's sleeping with her, and she's just sort of there. And I was just rolling my eyes, like, of course, the drunk writer has this hot girl who just wants to sleep with him. But she has the section where she talks about being exploited in a porno. And it's kind of a girl's gone wild thing that she had found herself in. And it was a really great monologue that she gives in this book. And I thought it brought her character kind of full circle. The things that were problematic for me... I became aware that Ron Curry Jr., the writer, was also aware that they were problematic and was wrestling with those issues in a good way.
I think what he does in his book, I think it's genius. I think he sets up all of the cliches of the tough guy, drunk writer, obsessed with a woman, who then gets this young woman, and that's what he wants you to to read, because that would be your memoir. That would be the thing that it would be. And then he goes about deconstructing every single trope.
Yes.
And you know what I'm reminded of, actually, and maybe the Manic Pixie Dream Girl has existed far before this, is that I kept thinking oddly about The End of the Affair by Graham Greene and The Good Soldier by Ford Madox Ford while I was reading this. I know these are two pretty divergent books to compare to Flimsy Little Plastic Miracles by Ron Curry Jr., but they both are about unreliable narrators. The End of the Affair, the main character, the narrator, is a novelist, and it's unreliable narrators dealing with obsessive compulsive love and attraction, and the depths that they will go both to have that person and attempt to forget that person. And I kept thinking more End of the Affair than The Good Soldier, but End of the Affair specifically because of the writing angle, because what Ron Curry Jr., the character, keeps doing in the book is he keeps rewriting himself, that he keeps putting himself into situations that seem like the sort of situations you would read in a memoir or read in a novel, and then he does things that deconstruct that. And so it makes me wonder also if I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, oh, I love all this stuff because I am aware of the tropes that he is exploding. If someone doesn't know the tropes, maybe they're just like, oh, this is weird. Why does he have this, you know, drunk girl with him or something?
So give me a specific example of him deconstructing a trope.
Well, let me take the example that I just gave. I think that she starts off as this pliable young female who's just a body that he can have sex with. That's the sort of function that Charlotte serves in this book. And I was rolling my eyes because I hate the idea. And I feel like this pops up, like Todd was saying, in every novel where there's a drunk author. There's just women just throw themselves at that guy. And they just think he's so smart. And he doesn't care about them, but he'll, you know, take advantage of their bodies in this gross way. And I feel like a lot of that's a tradition. There's a literary trope of that. So I was like rolling my eyes about the, oh, there's another book where you're screwing an undergrad. You know, way to go, old fat drunk writer. But then she has this amazing monologue where she talks about being exploited in quotes by being asked to have sex with guys on camera, and she describes the scene and she talks about how empowering it was for her. And it's such a weird monologue that she gives, where she's talking about giving this guy a blowjob and feeling like she was the one in control, and that she reversed the power dynamics of the situation in such a way that it paid for her vacation, it gave her strength, it made her into a better person in her own eyes. And it's such a weird monologue, because you're like, oh, do I trust that she's right, that she was empowered by the situation, or is this a victim of sexual abuse rationalizing her own victimization? And I just thought it was a nuanced, really insightful description of something that, I don't know, it took me out of the male writer perspective that you're criticizing this book for, in a way that I thought was really accurate and profound and interesting and fresh. And I was like, impressed by Ron's ability to write that monologue for that character and insert that into this book, which makes all the tropes that he's playing with problematic and questionable.
But there's a new trope here, though, and this is related to the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and I think...
I just love that term. It really is. I wish I'd known this term before. I'd be using it a lot.
In Gone Girl, which I'm sure a lot of our listeners have read, there's like a 5-page description of the idea, the like modern idea of the cool girl that like all men want and a lot of women also want. So the idea is like, oh, I'm cool. Like, I have beers and, like, I'll stay out late and we can have threesomes and I enjoy giving blowjobs to everybody. Yeah, I'm the cool girl. And, like, it's so much more nuanced than what I'm saying that it really affected me. And I know that there are so many other people who have mentioned that part of that book, because it's the idea is, like, this is what we all want now. We all want the cool girl. And, like, and that is Manic Pixie Dream Girl. It's the same thing of like, oh yeah, I'm down for whatever. You know what I mean?
Oh, so you're saying that the Charlotte monologue just ends up becoming another level of Manic Pixie Dream Girlness?
Yes.
Interesting. I took that passage as damning of Ron. Like, I read that passage and I was like, that now he's got to recognize that he's dealing with a real human being and he doesn't want to. And he, you know,
well,
and I thought that that whole passage was inserted in there to Because, I mean,
right.
he doesn't even refer to Charlotte by name for the first couple chapters she appears in. And I just love that idea that she becomes a more and more of a person until she leaves the book. And then you're kind of like, God damn it. Charlotte was actually smart and had interesting things to say, and you never took advantage. So you're angry at your narrator. And I thought that that's the point. I mean, that was the point of inserting that monologue. It's like, here you had an actual interesting, awesome person by your side who has this whole complicated relationship with her father and alcoholism,
right.
And you're just an asshole. And I just loved that judgment being inserted into the book. You hate the narrator in that moment. And I thought that that was a way to really complicate the Manic Pixie Dream Girl quality.
And I think by the same token, what happens in the book that, and I won't spoil the end of this here, but, you know, at some point, what Ron Curry Jr., the character, does is he basically litigates what narrative is. Now, does that make for great entertaining reading for a person sitting by their pool if they're not, you know, huge book dorks like us? I don't know. I mean, I found that really fascinating and an interesting thing.
I did.
But I don't know if it's, you know, the sort of stuff a consumer picks up at Walmart and is like, oh, I want to read a book that deconstructs narrative. So I think it's a really hard book. Because it's essentially plotless. It depends on the reader investing in a constant battle in their head over what they choose to or not to believe about a character who's telling them their story without a lot of things blowing up.
It's a story about the act of storytelling,
right,
essentially.
Right, exactly.
And there are a lot of books like that. You know what I mean? I think this isn't a unique... Like, that idea isn't the first time that it's been presented. So my question is, what does this say about storytelling that matters? You know what I mean? Like, what are the consequences of this if it is true?
To me, I think this book says a lot of the same things that Cheryl Strayed's Dear Sugar said. I feel like it's a really contemporary, important message about empathy and honesty in the internet age and in an age of... dissemination of information where misinformation is equal to information, and you know, where we all live in this sort of fiction creating life of Facebook or whatever, however we contend with our identities. We all are aware of the notion of an identity as something that we have to build, and that there's a story, a brand for everybody. And you can't just be anymore. You have to sort of engage with the world in this level of how you're going to be with a capital B, or tell the truth with a capital T. And I just think that the two books that I was reminded of is Dear Sugar, like I said, and then also a book by Jennifer Egan called The Visit from the Goon Squad, which I really love.
I love that book.
And and that book dealt with a lot of these issues in more narrative form and less directly, but this question of how do we communicate and how do we know what's honest and real in this age of information where we can just go online and Google anything we want. And I really think he nailed some stuff that we're going to be talking about, you know. And at first I hated all the singularity discussion because it just seemed so like pop cultural TED Talky bullshit, like, you know, you know what I mean? It just didn't, it was pop philosophical, I guess. But I actually think that he is intending it to be pop philosophical, where you're kind of like, oh, this reads like an essay on the Terminator movies or whatever, because it has this like vaguely apocalyptic thing. But by the end, the combination of all this, you know, pseudo-intellectual conversation about singularity and the real emotions that I started to feel about his father's death and how he was able to really draw me into that and make me cry reading this book, then those two things intersected on these questions. Like, Todd, you were saying, I wanted to Google him. I wanted to know if this was true. And then I was like, no, that's the whole point that this book is saying. Don't Google it. Just feel the emotion, feel the connection. And I thought there's a lot to this book. I kind of want to reread it because I feel like it's so dense.
I think the thing that you're talking about in relation to the identity and the truth of identity and that sort of thing is that everything that he talks about in the book boils down to a simple thing, which is that if you don't connect on a human level with people, you let basically the machines of our life drive your emotions. So, you know, this book comes out based on his life, that, or based on his writings after he dies, and it becomes this huge bestseller, basically. Nicholas Sparks of the Thesaurus, one review calls it, in the book, which I thought was a funny line. And all of a sudden, this narrative about this man, Ron Curry Jr.'s life, becomes the truth. This novel becomes their truth, but it's not his real life. And the only things that are true are, you know, his relationships with his friends or with his mother or with Emma. All these things that were actual skin to skin, as it were, that's what he cares about. He doesn't care about all the other things. And I think it is a damning indictment on our life of social media, which then brings into question the fact that I contacted Ron on Facebook to tell him how much I love the book. Yeah. But there you go.
That's interesting.
But you know, I think it goes to the book functions as a reminder that you have to love the people that are in front of you and not the people that you'll never meet.
Well, I will read this book again. I will promise that to you guys because everything you're saying, well, wait, yeah, hang on one second. I everything you guys are saying, this is such a writer thing to say, is like what I want to feel, you know, and read. And like when it got to the singularity stuff, like I was like, okay, yes, this is a subject I am interested in, you know, but it just, like, I couldn't connect the parts in my brain. And there must have been a point at which I was, you know, where that was never going to happen. So I'm going to give it a reread and try again.
I know what you didn't like about the book. And you know, I think that there is some posturing. You know, there's some clear, like, masculine.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. On.
And for me, the posturing that never was made ironic and never really questioned is all the violence and the beating. Mm-hmm. I just thought it was so stupid, and I thought it was so. I wouldn't have minded like one scene of him getting beat up, but his face is pounded, his teeth are lost, he watches a horse get beat, he's getting in fights constantly, and it's so stupid, and it doesn't really lead anywhere, and it doesn't really pay off except to forge this image of Ron Curry as this bruiser who could take
I think you are completely wrong. I think
really
the,
you think that
the fighting has a reason,
because I kept waiting for it, like the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, to come full circle and to sort of be mocked by himself, and it wasn't. He loved the idea of him as this bruised,
no, you're reading it wrong. The only time he feels anything is when he's getting hit.
Yeah.
The only time he actually has a connection to the world is,
yeah, and that is when he's being beaten. That is a cliche, Fight Club bullshit. And that right there is not mocked in the book. He actually believes that makes him kind of cool and sexy. And I feel like that drips off the page, and I think it's bullshit. What? He loves the idea. Like, even one of the most emotionally potent scenes is him standing, and I did love this scene, is him standing up for his father, and it's a physical confrontation. He loves violence, and he's holding that
up. What about that he loses most of his fights?
Well, that's that Fight Club, like, feeling the pain makes life more real kind of bullshit theme that I just don't... I didn't buy it. Like, I just thought it was such posturing.
It's funny, because some of the fight scenes I enjoyed because they were so detailed. Like, we also haven't talked about... I think their writing is pretty, like, breezy and removed. You know, it's not, like, full of rich details for me. I mean, and that can often be wonderful, so that's not a direct criticism. But what it came across feeling like is, like, this book is so unbelievably masculine. It's, like, it's about sex, daddy issues, getting punched, and computers. That is what this
so
book
true.
Is about.
Oh, my God.
So I'm like, it's the kind of thing that once you notice it, you can't, like, unsee it. You know what I mean? And so, like, I put something, like, I just wanted the theme of, like, we need to be close to people. Like, yes, okay, yes, but being close to people doesn't just mean having sex with them or getting punched by them or both. You know what I mean? Like, there's so much richness to, like, human connection and interaction that I felt like there could have been more. And I was like, oh, great. Now we're on to, like, let's take a break from fucking and punch someone.
So if you read Hemingway, for instance, which is the prototypical man book, do you have a difficult time identifying
no
emotion in Hemingway that like you do here? No. Why not?
No. Because I don't mind. It's not even that I don't mind. Like, I, most of my favorite writers are men. Like, I love a lot of these things. It's not the fact that, I mean, it's not the fact that he's a man or it's masculine themes. It's that it's like a lack of richness in other areas. Like, I mean, yeah, Hemingway is very masculine, but it's about hunting or bullfighting or like tangible emotional things in the world, like interacting with the world more than I ever felt in this book. You know what I mean? Like everything felt in service. Everything in this book felt in service to, you know, this question of like, you know, what's true, what isn't true, or it, you know, it didn't ground itself in details that I connected with. Now that is not like, I'm sounding like I completely hated this book, which is not true, but there was a moment where I was like, I'm just there. It's not connecting. It's just, there's no emotional connection happening for me. You know what I mean? And maybe for other people who would, you know, connect with these specific things, that would be completely untrue. But I, it's not that he's male. It's that it was such an easy use of so many different male tropes together that once I recognized it, just was distracting. You know what I mean?
At one point, he ends up in the Middle East, roaming the desert with a guy and a couple camels. I didn't buy that. Like, I never bought that. Like, I just didn't buy that, you know. It was this sort of, like, do you guys remember Legends of the Fall? That horrible yes. movie? And, like, whenever it's, like, you know, the bear inside of Tristan was...
I oddly don't remember Hobo Johnny in Legends of the Fall. But...
No, it's the Native American. The bear inside of Tristan was tired and needed to rest for three winters.
Yes. That's yes, how it's that's all. True. Yes, that's correct.
And it's all this stupid, like, hyper-masculinity. Like, he needed to go soul-searching by being a pirate on the high seas before, you know, he could come back and love her again. And it's all this stupid, like, it's like a romance novel for guys, you know? It's like this idea of, like, you need to be a man and go out and kill a bear. And I felt the same way with this stuff of, like, him, like, looking off into the distance while he hikes through the desert.
I think that's intentional.
And, like, you know, stares off and has, you know, sand in his mouth for 4 years while he thinks about things.
I think that is entirely intentional. I think that he is playing with that trope. I mean, and, you know, he doesn't find enlightenment. That's the thing. What he finds is a U.S.-made mine that blows the shit out of a camel and his friend. You know, what he finds is a machine in the middle of the desert, basically. And so, you know, I think this vision quest that he goes on into the Middle East, not unlike going to the island, which is, you know, something that would happen to, you know, Hemingway or something, is what we want out of these, you know, these narratives about these men that go on journeys. As much as we want to see Cheryl Strayed hike that Pacific Trail, we want a guy to go find himself in the wilderness. That is the cliche. That is that Jack London shit that we have grown up with. And I think...
And you think... You're saying he's aware absolutely. Of that. And he's playing with that.
I think he's absolutely going along with that. And that...
That was sort of my assumption, too. But just listening to Julia talk about it, I can also see that there are these threads that don't... Like, the violence for me didn't come full circle. And I don't know if this vision quest was meant as ironically as you're posing it to be.
Well, it feels kind of earnest. To agree with Todd for a minute, like if he wasn't
this episode 27, Julia agrees with me.
One time. I mean, if he wasn't self-aware, why wouldn't he just have Mary Sued the whole thing and, you know, made it someone else or just written a novel? Like, obviously he's like grappling with what's true and not true, you know, or for himself. Right. I just think that it could have been done in a way differently for me that I would have really... I when I don't like a book, it's usually because I know I would have loved it, and then it, like, went wrong in my brain somewhere. But it's probably on me. I'm probably just sexist.
But I'm actually liking this book less and less. Jesus Christ. About it. I don't know. Now that I think about it, I don't know if the book really addressed the major problem with him as a character.
Well...
That he's dead inside, primarily?
No, I think being dead inside is like a sexy problem. It's like a, you know, that's what I mean. I feel like, Yeah, he holds himself up to be like, I just needed to feel something. So I did all this to just feel alive again, to feel my love for Emma again. And that's really like, it's like in movies, whenever, you know, somebody gets wounded in a movie and they're a hero, you notice they always get hurt in the shoulder where it's sexy to get hurt and like where it doesn't actually hit any organs. And it's like they could just wrap it up and keep going and like, okay.
Sexy wounds.
But, you know, here's the my final thought on the book. I still absolutely love it. And I still think it does fascinating things with narrative and questions narrative. I think for a third book, it is also a really big chance that Ron Curry Jr. has taken as a writer. So his first book was somewhat, it was sort of an interconnected collection of short stories, God is Dead, about what happens when God comes to Earth in the body of a woman and is attacked by feral dogs and dies. And then his second book, Everything Matters, is about a young boy who knows the day when the world is going to end. It's foretold to him when he's a very small child. And so their books are sort of sci-fi-ish, sort of slipstream-ish in terms of the world itself and what is true and what is not true and where things might go into the future. And then here you have a book where he deconstructs his own deconstructions about the world in his first two books. Which is also, you know, it opens up the avenue of people saying, well, is the book that he wrote, the first book, about this Emma character? I should go check and see, you know, what this is about. So it's, you know, to write this sort of metafiction after writing two pieces of fiction that are speculative in a way, I think is a really challenging thing. This is a far more literary novel than his first two were. You know, I give him big props for not doing anything simple. He is constantly asking big questions as a writer. And that, for me, I look at it and say, man, this guy, he does not give a shit what anyone says. He's going to write what he wants to write, and hopefully he's going to find an audience with it.
Yeah, so I like that. I like that, too.
Yeah, I do, too. It's ambitious.
Yeah, it's sure. Absolutely ambitious. Absolutely ambitious.
We respect you, Ron Curry, and even though you probably don't like me, I promise I'll read your book again.
Ron, her name is Julia Pistel. She lives in Connecticut, not far from you. I can get you her address. Well, that was Flimsy Little Plastic Miracles by Ron Curry Jr. I recommend it highly. Writers' opinions are evolving. Julia wish it never existed.
That is not true.
Julia also has no soul. So.
Yeah, that is true. That part's true.
And that's the end of this episode of Literary Disco. Join us in 2 weeks when we discuss a nonfiction essay. We'll post a link to it on our Facebook page and on our Twitter feed. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/literarydisco, and follow us on Twitter @literarydisco. Thanks for listening.